Some stations on shortwave sound like they've been around since the dinosaur era, presenting stories the way they did in the 160s, 70s, and 80,000 years ago. Snap out of your Mesozoic mood and switch to Radio Netherlands, contemporary continental radio from the heart of Northwest Europe.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks for PCJ Online. Just about to push the button on another program from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
By shortwave and satellite, this is Radio Netherlands. Media Network, a weekly survey of international communication developments. Produced and presented by Jonathan Marks.
Hello. Many of you will have heard or read about the dramatic end to the first ever crossing of the Atlantic by hot air balloon. Last Friday, millionaire businessman Richard Branson and his Swedish partner Per Lindstrand had to parachute into the sea off Northern Ireland when they encountered technical difficulties. Anyone in this part of Europe with a shortwave receiver tuned to 5680 kHz upper sideband would have been able to monitor the rescue operation as it happened. The British naval vessel, Argonaut, and several aircraft were coordinated through a control station in Scotland's capital city, Edinburgh. The distance and terrain involved meant that high-frequency communications had to be used. The mode of operation was simplex, that is, all stations using the same frequency, so it was possible to follow exactly what was happening. Reception here in Holland was so good, it broke through onto a simple shortwave receiver that I was testing at 1818 UTC.
Worship Argonauts, Edinburgh Rescue, reference your last. Mr. Branston and his fellow survivor will be taken to Kilmarnock Hospital. Suggest vacant telephone from there. Over.
So a bit of real-life drama on an otherwise quiet part of the shortwave dial. As a footnote, the rescue took place very close to Rathlin Island, from where Marconi made his first successful radio transmission back in 1898. Now, joining me is Mike Bullen as we survey other developments in the media field. Mike.
It's known that the Tamil militants in Sri Lanka, who are fighting for an independent state in the north and east of the country, operate pirate broadcasting stations. So far, two such broadcasts have been identified as coming from across the water. Radio listeners in India even visited one of the stations, broadcasting with modified amateur radio equipment on the outskirts of Madras in Tamil Nadu. The equipment was first purchased and tried on the air in West Germany at the start of the 1980s. The visitors were given a cautious welcome.
6,900 kHz. This program is the official broadcast of the People's Liberation Organization of Tamilia.
That's the voice of Tamil Eelam, based in Tamil Nadu. On the other side of the current conflict, the Sri Lankan government has been busy with its own stations too. During the latter part of May, when the Colombo government organised a major offensive, radio enthusiasts in the north of the island observed the appearance of a new medium-wave station. Calling itself Sri Lanka Broadcasting Corporation Jaffna, signals were heard on 1030 kHz with announcements in Tamil and English. The transmissions must have come from within one of the government military compounds, for the programmes included information and orders issued by the security chief to the public, such as the imposition of curfews. Government officials living in the area were summoned to meetings by the SLBC Jaffna station. But there's a curious twist to the story. 2 years ago, a strong station appeared on shortwave, operating very near to the 7 MHz frequency used by the Tamil Nadu-based Voice of Tamil Eelam. It first called for reason.
Time and time again, the bankrupt politicians of Tamil Nadu and our leaders keep on condemning the imperialistic Americans.
Those broadcasts had no name. After some interruptions, similar strong signals were heard identifying as the Communist Party of Tamil Eelam. This was heard regularly until May of this year. It has taken the line that the liberation groups in Tamil Nadu don't have the best interests of the people at heart, whilst criticising the Sri Lankan government as well. But the same voice that did all the announcing for the Communist Party of Tamil Eelam appeared on the Sri Lanka Broadcasting Corporation Jaffna station.
That report was compiled from a variety of sources in Sri Lanka and southern India. Let's change continents now, and the results of a rather extensive direction-finding campaign in Latin America became known this week. For years there have been a variety of clandestine stations or programs criticizing the Cuban government of Fidel Castro.
Con ustedes, Cuba independiente y democrática.
That's the voice of an independent and democratic Cuba, as the title translates, and it's clearly very well organized. Started by ex-Castro supporter Hugo Matos in Miami, Florida, a number of years ago, the organization behind The Voice quickly moved its transmitter facilities outside the USA after a brush with the FCC. The organization has, and in fact continues, to hire airtime from Radio Clarín in the Dominican Republic, as well as Ecos del Torbes in Venezuela. But CRD clearly has its own facilities too. A CRD service called Radio Camilo Cienfuegos, heard on 9940 kHz, appears to be coming from just outside San Salvador in El Salvador, according to direction finding. The power must be in the region of 10 kilowatts. Another service called Radio Caiman, the voice of the new generation, again aimed at Cuba, comes from Guatemala City, according to the research. 9960 kHz is the frequency, the power again being around 10 kilowatts. Right, time now for our station ID.
Radio Netherlands programs around the clock if you understand nine languages.
Next from the Netherlands, our clandestine radio columnist, John Campbell.
Usually I report on what specially interesting clandestine stations can be heard and how you can get in touch with them. Well, some of them anyway, by mail. But it's also good to go behind the scenes once in a while and get some of the background to what you can hear or read about. Those of you who have seen the World Radio TV Handbook, and I assume that's most of you, probably believe that all of the stations in the official-looking national tabulations are official. But don't bet on that. For example, in Indonesia and Bolivia, though mainly on medium wave, quite a few listed stations haven't paid much attention to the official licensing regulations, and the powers of enforcement there are not too strong outside Jakarta or La Paz. So, if you have an unlicensed station in a provincial town and good friends in local politics or the army there, you can do more or less what you want, provided that you make the right regular donations to somebody's benevolent fund. And if the central government authorities come looking for you during one of the very occasional clean-up drives, you can ask your friends to help in turning you into an official station, say for the local government authority or for the local army base. That's the story in both Indonesia and Bolivia. And it's almost the same story in Ireland too. Well, at least apart from the references to the army. Although the army there did once set up recruitment commercials on the Dublin commercial pirate Sunshine Radio, and the responsible government minister answered a question about that in the Irish Parliament by saying it was quite all right. Their market surveys had shown that there were less listeners for the commercials on the official government channel RTE than there were for the commercials on Sunshine Radio. Also, the Irish story hasn't yet reached the point of an official cleanup. There are too many other more exciting things happening in Irish politics. So all the medium wave stations, except for RTE, that are given in the Irish entry in the World Radio TV Handbook are still unlicensed. Their numbers are increasing too. So now for some background. If you want to start broadcasting in Ireland, what do you do about, for example, getting a transmitter? There are at least two ways to go about it, and there are friends in business in either way who are eager to help you. The first method is to go to a transmitter broker, like Irish Broadcast Consultants in Armagh, Northern Ireland, who are safe there as long as all their sales items are exported to another country, like the Irish Republic. These fellows find their transmitters in North America, from regular stations there that go bankrupt or buy newer equipment. You need a heavy pocket to go by this route, but you get real brand names for your money, like a 1973 10-kilowatt RCA transmitter, surplus to somebody's requirements in Hamilton, Ontario, for $22,500, somewhat older Harris or RCA equipment from places like Cleveland for about half the price, and for vintage enthusiasts, a 1955 Gates 5C5B in perfect condition, they say, for a mere $9,300. These prices are all very well for adventurous startups with commercial backers in Dublin and Cork, but they're not very practical for somebody in a place like Kilnaleck, County Cavan, which consists of two farms and not much else. At the low end of the market, though, there are some fine Irish homebrew transmitter builders who'll put your order on the end of their production line in their kitchens or their garages. That means some good news and some bad news. The bad news is that the circuitry for some amplifying stages is not very modern, and it's very prone to generating and not suppressing harmonic radiation. If you're a distant listener, though, the good news is that these harmonics allow you to hear Irish stations a long way away when the fundamental frequencies may be blocked by much higher-powered official stations in other countries. The harmonics and the carrier profiles are a bit like artist signatures on paintings. They allow shortwave art experts to tell you who built the transmitter. For Irish harmonic enthusiasts, who also like to collect new counties on the air from Ireland, I'd suggest monitoring 2070 kHz, where there are faint harmonic noises from a so far unnamed station testing from Tullamore, the first time that County Offaly has hit the airwaves. The fundamental frequency is 1035. I know from first-hand observation that the same kind of thing happens, in more or less the same way, in Indonesia and Bolivia. But I'll save up those stories for some other time.
Thanks, John. And now it's music time. Climbing the American pop charts at the moment, rather slowly, is a new single by singer Gary Numan. But as Lou Josephs has been telling me from Boston, it's the illustration on the cover wrapped round the record, entitled Radio Heart, by the way, that's the most interesting.
Yes, the cover has a shortwave dial and a medium wave dial. On the shortwave band, you'll find some classic stations like Boundbrook, which was an old VOA transmitter site, and the transmitter site at Schenectady, which was at one time used by WGY, the BBC Overseas Service, a transmitter site located in Chongqing, a transmitter site located in Zessen. And then on the medium wave dial, we have things like the BBC Forces Berlin, we have Bremen, we have the Paris PTT, we have Cologne, Prague, Brussels, and a station in Hilversum.
That sounds familiar.
Radio Heart, who plays that song for me? The one from the heart, so she'll come back to me.
Radio Heart, they're singing. That's what it says on the cover, anyway. So, Lou, what about this record's star potential to promote international broadcasting to the world?
It'll never be a hit, to be honest.
Oh dear, we're not all that musical after all. And while we replace the needle, let's go over to our bookshelf. Joining me now, Ginger De Silva.
Riding on the crest of the radio nostalgia wave is a new 137-page paperback book. It's published by Funk, a monthly German-language electronics magazine, and this new book is in German, too. The author is Neil Schiffauer, and he surveys 36 older shortwave receivers, including such names as Collins 390A, Hallicrafters SX-122A, Raycal AR-88, and the Yaesu FRG-7. The book contains beautiful black-and-white photographs and a 2-to-3-page explanation of each receiver. It's more of an explanation than a detailed comparison of these old receivers. Some technical specifications are included, though not each review has the same item for comparison. Figures for sensitivity, selectivity, and image rejection are given in each case based on measurements when the sets were new.
Put alongside modern receivers, though, these older sets are often bulky, though they tend to be much cheaper. The only problem may be servicing such a radio if it goes wrong. Few second-hand stores sell these radios with a guarantee, and the sources of further information in this new paperback book are rather brief. The book includes an idea of how much one of these old receivers is worth, at least in West Germany. We paid 21 German marks for our copy a few weeks ago, which isn't that expensive for the information offered, and an interesting reference source to have on the shelf. The title is Oldie Kurzwellenempfänger by Neil Schiffauer, published by Verlag für Technik und Handwerk in Baden-Baden. Again, remember the text is in German. Now to a book in English, published by Guilford Shortwave of Park Ridge, New Jersey, USA. It's called More Radio Receiver, Chance or Choice. In fact, it's a follow-up to a book first published in 1985. Rainer Lichter is the West German author with his own test equipment and results, and this 96-page paperback covers reviews on 14 recent receivers. Included are the Low HF125, JRC NRD525, Satellite 650, well, so the list goes on. In fact, as well as the Yaesu FRG9600 and ICOM ICR7000 VHF-UHF communication receivers. In the last 6 months, several receiver test books have appeared in Western Europe. Some have concentrated purely on amateur radio, testing shortwave broadcast receivers merely as an afterthought. But Lichter clearly knows what he's doing. I asked him on the phone earlier this week if this new book is simply a translation of his regular technical reviews published in Germany.
It's the same idea, but I'm not translating the reviews. I'm writing the reviews especially for the American market because people have different views on things overseas than they do have here. I think they look more for convenience features, appearance. The price is also very important. Some receivers that are very expensive here are even more expensive in the United States, like the Satellite Grundig. I think it's retail $1,298.
Right.
Which is a little bit outrageous, and I wanted to tell the people if the receiver is worth the money, for instance.
Lichter certainly talks straight in the book, using the text to review the practical aspects of the set and tables to show the more technically orientated results of his lab measurements. Rainer makes the interesting observation that many of the new sets are simply old ideas in new cases.
I mean, I have analyzed the schematics fairly thoroughly. This was a contract for some other company in Germany, and I've looked at about 15 different receivers. And you can really trace the basic circuit diagram back 10 to 12 years.
So there's nothing new?
No, it's not really something new. They took something out here and put new materials or new convenience features, or they substituted, let's say, 12 transistors with one integrated circuit that has the same performance. Except for the synchronous detector, there's really nothing new.
But you think we'll see more of the synchronous detection principle?
Yes, we will see synchronous detection, and of course we will see digitally processed RF and audio within the next 15 years, where they take samples of the RF or audio signal and process it like in an expensive measuring device and make variable filter curves and what have you. This will take at least 15 years until this comes onto the market.
At a price that we can afford?
I'd say the first year here in Europe, around 2,500 to 3,000 marks in about 15 years.
But you think it'll be too late at that point?
I mean, it will be the correct time, because the military is just starting out with those receivers, and it takes about 15 years until those breakthroughs are put onto the consumer market.
Gilfer sells the new update, receiver chance or choice, for $12.95, excluding shipping. That's rather expensive, especially for people outside the United States. Much better value is a combination of the old and new book for a price of $19.95. Either way, it still works out far cheaper than buying four or five individual computer-printed reviews from other sources in North America. More information from this address: Gilfer Shortwave, Box 239, Park Ridge, New Jersey, zip code 07656, USA. Mike, back to you.
Well, our English service has built up a reputation for free, informative and impartial booklets, but Radio Netherlands' Spanish and French services are also active. Our Spanish service produces a free guide to Spanish language broadcasts on shortwave, not just those of Radio Netherlands, in connection with the Spanish Media DX programme Radio Enlace. A latest edition was published back in March. They also produce a monthly Spanish language information bulletin designed mainly for DX clubs or organisations. Radio Netherlands' French service, on the other hand, runs a short weekly media feature, mainly for listeners in Africa. Some of the English language publications, such as the Receiver Shopping List and Latin American DXing, are now available in French, with amendments made to suit the target area. If you're interested in these, drop a line to the language service concerned.
You're listening to Media Network, and this is InfoDutch.
And InfoDutch stands for Information of Direct Use to Computer Hobbyists. There's a growing concern in computer hobbyist circles in the United States about proposed rulemaking currently before the Federal Communications Commission in Washington, D.C. Because you can send computer information down the phone many times faster than if you spoke it instead, the FCC is looking to levy charges on certain groups that send a lot of data down the phone. That includes the owners of private computer bulletin boards, who might have to pay a tax of up to $5 for every hour that their board is in use. We'll investigate that story further. Meanwhile, a line to Vienna, Austria has come up, where Wolf Herrent, editor of the German media programme Kurzwellen Panorama, has a software review for us. It'll mainly interest radio amateurs. Wolf.
Yes, indeed, Jonathan. It doesn't happen too often that you get a review copy of a computer program and decide to buy it on the spot. This exactly is what I did. After having tested SwissLog, a most useful and highly sophisticated program for ham operators, it's written for IBM PCs or fully compatibles under MS-DOS. Well, the first thing you expect from a logbook program is that it helps you to keep your log entries up to date. More than that, I can assure you. Let's assume your transceiver is switched on and you hear Oscar Echo 3 Whiskey Hotel Charlie calling CQ. As soon as you type in the call, a window opens on the screen and tells you that this is Austria Europe calling from the province of Niederösterreich. Gives you the beam direction, the distance in kilometers, and the XCC country info WAZ and ITE zone numbers. And provided you did already work it, all the dates of your first and last QSO with that particular station. Name and QTH of the operator are there as well, so you need not type them in again. Or try it with a fancy call sign like Alpha Bravo Zero India. And you will learn that this is Japan. Ask your partner for his QTH locator and you will get the precise distance in a second. There is a special input scheme for contests. You can postpone entries, for instance, when you work in a net. And updating or correcting entries is no problem at all. Suppose you just received a couple of QSLs. Call up the call sign, push the QSL button, and the log is updated without any fuss. What about printing a list? No problem either. Would you like to have it in chronological order? Would you prefer call signs or countries or bands or a special time span or ITU zones? Whatever you want, you get it. You can even create your own data selection criteria. Look up the handbook, it's German. Or the help screens, it's English, like the whole program, everything in English. Just takes a couple of minutes. At Swiss francs 95, this program is a real bargain. SwissLog can be obtained from Walter Bauer, that's Walter, Bauer like B-A-U-R, Hotel Bravo 9 Bravo Juliet Sierra, Medergutstraße 57, that's M-A-D-E-R, G-U-T and Straße like S-T-R-A-S-S-E, Medergutstraße 57 in 3018 Bern, Switzerland.
Is there anyone who doesn't need a disc or another gizmo to patch into their radios?
Well, accessories can be rather useful, and perhaps one of the most handy units for someone with a communications receiver that I saw at the Friedrichshafen Radio Fair a few weeks back was a double audio notch filter from Hans Georg Dierking of Dissen in West Germany. I asked him why they put a double notch in it.
It's very necessary to have double notch because you have very often distortion from an RTTY station, from a commercial station or from an amateur radio RTTY station. And so you need a double notch filter. And so you have a clear frequency and you can now listen very careful again to the information of the broadcasting station.
The filter simply plugs into a communications receiver's loudspeaker output, so an extra loudspeaker or a pair of headphones is also needed. We purchased a unit, set it up, and for a demonstration, I found an African station on 60 metres with a radio teletype station on top of it. Now, by playing with two controls on the front, you can reduce and almost eliminate those two tones without affecting the music you're trying to listen to. Here's the result. If I switch it back, once again switch it in, you can hear the difference there. Pretty effective. On the other hand, you can also use the unit to peak Morse or radio teletype signals for utility monitoring, thereby improving the copy quality. The unit we purchased and tested works very well, though it is quite expensive, 299 German marks including the built-in power supply. The filter covers a bandwidth from 100 to 4,500 Hz. That's a vast improvement for the broadcast listener over other filters of this type. Most commercial notch filters only offer a single notch and restricted bandwidth coverage, usually up to 2.7 kHz. The unit, once again, is marketed by G. Dierking of Dissen in West Germany.
Africa Media News Desk.
And a Telex report has just come in from our Southern African media monitor, Richard Jinby. So here's Ginger De Silva to voice his report.
A traditional Southern African clandestine station called Voice of the Black Cockerel Resistance appears to be operating from two places at once. Fiercely critical of the Angolan government, the station announces that its Channel A program is on between 3:30 and 5:30 UTC, and again between 19:30 and 21:30 on 4975 kHz, and between 12 and 1300 on 11980 and 15180 kHz, though 15180 doesn't seem to be active. They announce that the broadcasts come from Jamba, although it seems more likely that the transmitter is in South Africa. There's another service from the Voice of the Black Cockerel, though, called the B program. This appears between 600 and 800 UTC and 1930 and 2130 on 6030 kHz, and between 1100 and 1300 and 1500 and 1630 UTC on 9495 kHz. The transmitter is clearly further north and may be in Namibia. Meanwhile, in Angola, Radio Nacional in Luanda is now active 24 hours a day on these channels, 4953, 7245, 9535, 9720, and 11955 kHz. The regional station in Benguela has moved to 5044 and 6154 kHz. Listeners in Africa might help to solve the mystery on 9550 kHz around lunchtime. The clandestine program of the Sudan People's Liberation Army is put out between 1100 and 1200 UTC and between 1300 and 1400 via Ethiopia's external service. It is often blocked by a bubble-type jammer. At 1200 UTC, the Ethiopian transmitter moves to nearby 9560 for a program of the Voice of Revolutionary Ethiopia. However, on 9550, I'm hearing another transmitter between 1200 and 1300 playing non-stop Sudanese music. So where's that coming from? And finally, to Mozambique, where transmitters are constantly changing in frequency. The interprovincial program, which has been on 7050 kHz recently, has now moved back to around 7108 kHz.
We're out on location in Media Network next week, when the focus of attention will be interference and its suppression. Join us then. In the meantime, have a nice weekend.
Some stations talk to the world. Radio Netherlands talks to people.
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website.
This is Media Network with Jonathan Marks,
where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world.
Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.
I regret to inform you this recording is now officially over.